contemptible, self-serving cynics. They're creeps. They should have to swallow 1,000 buckets each of the bad water they forced on all of Flint's men, women, and children.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Okay, this is Craig Lubow, and thank you for joining us on Radioactive Magazine. My guest today is Jeffrey Mittman. He is the executive director of the Missouri chapter of the ACLU, that's American Civil Liberties Union.
He has been there since May of 2013. Previously, he was the director of the affiliate in Alaska. And before that, he was the deputy national field director for their legislative office in Washington, D.C. And before that, he was a coordinator for their campaign relating to the U.S. Patriot Act and post-9/11 issues. He has a degree in philosophy and is an attorney. And before he entered the nonprofit sector with ACLU, he practiced in private practice. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what I want to get into first, if you can give us an outline of the issues the Missouri chapter of ACLU is working on, and then we can go into more detail with some of those issues.
Certainly. Obviously, the ACLU nationally has been around for just under 100 years, as has the Missouri affiliate. Generally, what we try to do is preserve and expand constitutional rights and civil liberties, especially those guaranteed in the Bill of Rights. As you would guess, there's significant First Amendment issues that come up, government accountability, protecting the rights of all, ensuring privacy. Here in Missouri, I think people know that the last year and a half have brought to the forefront some of the racial tensions that have existed in Missouri gone unnoticed. So we're doing a significant amount of work in those areas. Up until this last year, we had been doing a lot of work related to LGBT equality. That shifted, obviously, with the Supreme Court decision in the Obergefell case. And there's some other issues. The death penalty, as you know, Missouri, unfortunately, is leading the country, along with Texas, Georgia, and Louisiana. So there's a number of issues. We are responsive to what comes to us and try to be proactive on the things we think will make Missouri a better state.
All right. Now, you mentioned racial issues, and I'm assuming the thing that brought it to the forefront was maybe Ferguson.
Well, interestingly, if you look at the history of Missouri, when I came here, it was interesting to kind of learn about the old courthouse in St. Louis and the Dred Scott case and the Missouri Compromise. In Ferguson, prior to the shooting of Mike Brown, there was a history of governmental policies that created racial segregation in housing and employment and education. Of course, as we began representing the entirety of the state and started spending time in Kansas City, we learned about the important desegregation cases in the school litigation here in Kansas City. So it's clearly been a long-standing issue. So Mike Brown we see not as the cause but really the symptom. Given that, we've tried to focus on a few areas, and that is, one, racial profiling in two zones. That's on the streets and in the schools. So, for example, the Missouri Attorney General has, for 15 years now, issued reports about who gets stopped for vehicle traffic and other stops in the state of Missouri. And essentially, in almost every municipality across the state, the differential is 2-1. In other words, if you're African American, you're twice as likely to be stopped by the police, to be searched, in some cases, be arrested. Interestingly, if you're white, you're actually more likely to have contraband. So that's certainly an area we're looking at. And then, of course, in the schools, we know it's the same thing. The school-to-prison pipeline, the differential treatment of students of color. Unfortunately, Missouri is number one in the entire country. We are the worst state in terms of differential treatment of students of color and majority students. So there's a lot of work to do.
Okay. You say it's a symptom as opposed to the cause. And what are some of the underlying things that you see as a cause? And also, you also mentioned the Missouri Attorney General with the guidelines for the stops.
Right.
Were the guidelines meant to fix that problem, or are they encouraging the problem?
Right. So, great question. So, first, in terms of the causes, we recently brought litigation in Ferguson on behalf of the Missouri NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. We brought suit against the Ferguson-Florissant School District under the Federal Voting Rights Act. And as part of that litigation, one of the things we need to present to the court and to tell the judge is there a history of racial polarization? And we had an expert from the University of Iowa who has, over the course of his professional career, studied the St. Louis metropolitan area. And what he discovered is there are governmental policies. For instance, we know after World War II, the government ensured that Americans could become homeowners. There was government funding to help people buy homes. What people don't know is that the rules were written by the government to redline, exclude African-American communities from being able to participate in those programs. When you add to that, for a majority of Americans, the biggest indicator of economic success is the inherited wealth that comes from home equity. Essentially, even in the post-Jim Crow era, in the post-slavery era, governmental policies continued to intentionally single out and exclude African Americans. There was testimony in the trial that as communities moved out and established school districts and municipalities, at every juncture, local and state governments excluded African Americans from full participation in the community. So when we look at that, add into it voting restrictions. For instance, what's going on right now at Jeff City in the Missouri State Capitol, legislators are trying to, again, make it harder for persons of color to vote. There's just year after year, policy after policy, that sends a clear message to communities of color, we are going to do everything to ensure that you don't get a fair chance. And we have to stop that.
And let me ask this, though. Is it that they are going after specifically communities of color based upon their culture? Or is it just that those happen to be the communities that tend to be in poverty and poor? In the states that are doing this, it seems like, at least, it's mostly Republicans that are trying to pass these laws.
Yeah, when you look at the history of the actions, it started out as racial divisions. Historically, there is an economic advantage to those with financial power to have an underclass, to have a group that can provide really inexpensive and undermarket cost labor. When you add into that the history of sort of racial divisions in the South and Missouri as a border slave state, those cultural norms continued. So the idea was, if you want to live in a community, you want your community to be all white. In the trial, there was testimony about the cities of Berkeley and Kinloch. When it came time to create a school district, the white community in Berkeley built a circle around Kinloch, which is predominantly African-American, so there would be two separate school districts so that the people would stay divided. Now, in addition, then, there are also lesser resources that are provided to the African-American community. So the poverty exists because there are intentional policies that excluded the African-American community from full economic opportunity. So there really was not a level playing field. And to this day, there is not a living playing field because of the years and years of governmental policies that ensured that African Americans would not have a fair shake.
In terms of what they're doing in modern times here with the voting rights, a lot of that would also be, though, that they're just going after, they want to exclude the groups that would tend to be more Democratic.
Yes, unfortunately, that is accurate, that in this case, the voter suppression efforts are being made by the Republican Party. Now, the ACLU, as I'm sure you know, is completely nonpartisan. We follow where the Constitution goes and, in fact, work very strongly with Republicans on a significant number of issues. For instance, privacy rights, civil asset forfeiture, the protection of due process. So there are certain issues where we work with both sides of the aisle. There are certain issues where we work more closely with Republicans. But yes, you're correct. On the issue of voter suppression, unfortunately, that has been something that has been predominantly put forward by Republican legislators. Unfortunately, well, the Secretary of State has done good review of the policies here in the state of Missouri. And if the constitutional amendment is passed, there would be essentially 220,000 voters who are disenfranchised. These are individuals for whom it is difficult to get the proper documentation, and they tend to be the elderly, the poor, persons of color, those who are disabled, and often more often in rural areas. So it really is there was an acknowledgement by one of the legislators who said, well, yes, there will probably be a differential disenfranchisement, but that was, quote unquote, an unintended consequence. We don't think that's the case.
And what specifically is the constitutional amendment trying to do?
So several years back, there was a law passed about requiring certain restrictive forms of ID. Fortunately, the Missouri Supreme Court said that is unconstitutional. So the effort now is to change the Missouri Constitution. We always strongly warn voters, anytime you see an effort to change the Constitution to take rights away, that should be a large red flag. And in this case, we will be doing everything in our power. Tomorrow, the ACLU will be up in Jeff City with our Voices of Liberty Lobberty Day, and we will be working to ensure that legislators know that Missourians do not want to change the Constitution to take rights away.
Right. Now, going to another issue, you talked some about that you worked on LGBT issues previously, and a little bit less so this year since the Supreme Court decision. Is moving away from that issue, has that been a little bit premature now in retrospect to what happened with the clerk in Kentucky?
Right.
And what some of the states are trying to do with using religious liberty?
Yeah, and I should clarify, I should say, actually, there has been a shift in orientation. So one of the things we remind people is there's a lot of work yet to do. Clearly, getting marriage equality was a huge step forward. But as we point out, in the state of Missouri, you can get married on Sunday and fired on Monday. So in other words, Missouri is unfortunately one of the states that do not have protections for LGBT persons in employment, housing, or public accommodation. It is absolutely legal for a landlord to look at two women and say, I do not want lesbians in my apartment, you are kicked out. It's perfectly legal in the state of Missouri for a gay couple to be dining in a restaurant and the restaurant owner to say, I don't want gay people eating here, you are kicked out. And there's nothing they can do. And there's some exceptions in some municipalities. But generally, that's the rule in the state of Missouri. Unfortunately, people don't realize that. It's so antithetical to American values that people assume, well, of course there's protections against that sort of invidious discrimination. But there's not. So, yes, working on passing MONA, the Missouri Non-Discrimination Act, is very much something we are working on. Unfortunately, there are challenges in this Missouri legislature, in this General Assembly. There are those who refuse to protect all Missourians on an equal basis. Another issue we're focusing on is transgender rights. There are significant limitations and obstructions put in the way of transgender individuals, particularly transgender students in school settings. We're working to make sure that the T in the LGBT community is protected. So there was a large victory in marriage, and certainly our marriage work has ended, but certainly the fight for LGBT equality is far from over, and we're continuing to partner with our friends and colleagues at PROMO, the statewide LGBT organization, and others who know there's more work to do.
And how do you balance what would the position of ACLU be in terms of balancing the individual rights of LGBT people and the religious liberty of people who go say, well, the First Amendment also protects religious freedom?
Right. So it's really interesting. So one thing I want to be very clear, the Mormon Church, the Catholic Church, the Southern Baptists, not only do they have a right in their doctrinal positions to say, we will not have a gay priest. Let me give you, for instance, people look at the Catholic Church, and I say to people, do you see any female Catholic priests? Of course not. Have you ever seen a lawsuit suing the Catholic Church for discrimination against women? Of course not. It is an absolute right within your religious community to set your church's doctrine. Not only is that the case, but on religious liberty grounds, if the government ever tried to tell, for example, a church that they had to change their policies because the government wanted them to do so, we'd be the first in line to defend them. That's not acceptable. So the idea of religious liberty is enshrined in the First Amendment. Now, let's shift a little bit. Let's say there's a church that has a bingo hall that they rent out for for-profit purposes to have bingo. Now, do we want to say that in their bingo hall that they have the right to say gay people can't play bingo? We think not. There's a distinction between those activities we do within the confines, within our religious communities, within our private associations, and those things we do when we enter into the public marketplace. And the rule in American culture has always been, when you go out in the public marketplace, when you open a business, whether it's a florist shop or a bakery shop or a wedding chapel, you become part of the American community. So that's where the dividing line is. And unfortunately, sometimes people use religion as an excuse to discriminate. So I want to be clear. There are two distinct realms. In the religious realm, in a Sunday school, in church services, in worship, absolutely protected. In the public sphere, we don't get to say, well, I am a strong Christian. I don't want to serve Muslims in my restaurant. Or I am an Orthodox Jew. I don't want women sitting next to men in my housing complex. That's where we draw the line. And it's worked for many years, and I think it's the right policy for us as Americans.
And in those states where, like Indiana and Arkansas, that have passed some of those religious freedom laws, are those restaurants in those states allowed to discriminate there?
Well, it's interesting. In many of the states, what you see is, it's fascinating, by and large now, the business community understands the best way to run a business is to be inclusive. I don't know if you remember a few years back when Arizona was looking at one of these laws, the governor didn't sign it. The reason she didn't sign it is the NFL said, if you sign this law, we're not bringing the Super Bowl to your state. So there is a clear understanding in business that inclusive values, being open for business for everyone, is good business. So more and more, and you saw a similar situation in Indiana where there was so much pressure in saying, this is un-American. We are not going to pass a law that says you can choose to discriminate. And what people remembered is, essentially, if they were to do those things, there would be nothing to say that, let's say, a Muslim baker didn't want to let Christians into his or her bakery. And people realize it's really not the right way to do things. So more and more, these bills are not getting serious traction. They're not being treated seriously. And our hope is and our belief is that they will quickly go into the dustbin of history.
Okay. Now, looking at what happened in Kentucky with the clerk who doesn't want to sign off on marriage licenses, is there a way to develop something, some kind of a compromise that would allow her personally not to have to sign off and still protect the LGBT community?
Yeah, and you know, it was interesting. When you looked at in Kentucky, even conservative commentators said, not a real issue. Her job as the clerk is to sign county documents. It's not saying that she approves or disapproves. That's part of her job. It would be, if I were to go into a butcher shop, have them hire me as a butcher to cut up the meats, and then say, oh, by the way, I'm vegan and I don't believe in the killing of animals, so I want you to pay me, but I can't do the job you hired me for. And again, what we see often is this sort of false claim of religious liberty when that's not what it's about. This woman was hired and ran to be the clerk to perform a ministerial function. By doing that, she's not saying, I personally believe in this marriage. She's just doing her job. So in cases, for instance, going back to those religious, those doctrinal positions, the churches, absolute protections and no compromise even necessary. There is nothing the government can do or should do or the ACLU would permit the government to try to do to tell any church what their religious policies are and who they will marry and how they will marry them. That's protected. But in a governmental function where we expect our government functionaries to serve our needs, you don't get to pick and choose who you'll choose serve.
All right. Another issue you mentioned was the death penalty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, we've got several groups: ACLU, Amnesty International, Missourians
for alternatives
to death penalty.
Wonderful.
To work on that.
Yeah.
Does the strategy or the perspective of ACLU differ in how to approach that issue than those other organizations?
Yeah, no. The ACLU believes that the death penalty is improper. Anyone who looks at the way it has been imposed understands we have made mistakes. We are killing innocent people. It is clear from the statistics that it is differentially imposed based on race and class. There was a case in St. Louis area where the prosecutor essentially kicked off African-Americans from the jury so that the African-American defendant would not be tried by a jury of his peers. You may know there's a case going forward in Georgia. Same thing happened where essentially by all the potential jurors' names, the prosecutors wrote a big B and circled it to identify African-Americans. So it is so problematic. The number of exonerations where we have proven that those who have been convicted and sentenced to death are demonstrably innocent is just stunning. Here in Missouri, the ACLU has brought a significant amount of litigation. As you know, we worked with public radio to expose the way our government was improperly accessing drugs to be used for executions, which was not proper. They were not to be sold for that reason. We had litigation related to the anesthesiologist who alleged that he or she is board certified, but we know that the American Board of Anesthesiology does not permit their members to participate in executions. We know that there's documents that have been withheld. We're challenging the way the witnesses have been selected. Time after time, when you look in the state of Missouri, the way the death penalty is being imposed is so shrouded in secrecy. And every time we look at it more closely, there are indications of improper procedures. If this is something our government truly believed was right, they should do it in the light of day and be clear about how they're doing it and why they're doing it. I think the way they impose it, the way they're treating it, the procedures and practices indicate they know it's a shameful act that needs to be stopped.
What about another issue? I don't know that I saw this on your website. In the schools, as far as freedom of speech and how students what kind of protections they have.
Right. There's one of the joys of being part of the ACLU is you get to meet some of your heroes. Back in the days when I worked at the ACLU of Northern California, I got to meet Fred Korematsu, who's the gentleman who challenged the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. I got to meet Mary Beth Tinker, who's famous. She and her brother wore black armbands to protest the Vietnam War. And the Supreme Court essentially said that students do not give up their First Amendment rights at the schoolhouse doors. So we are constantly working to protect the rights of students. Shortly after the Mike Brown shooting, Governor Nixon came here to Kansas City and was spinking at Lincoln Preparatory School. The students there are really bright. It's a wonderful academically oriented high school that has great success with students. And there were a few students who said, "The governor's coming here to give us an award for our school when he has not yet spoken about Mike Brown." So what they did is they very respectfully, intentionally sat in the very last row and simply stood up and held their hands up in silent protest, not interfering, not disrupting. And unfortunately, they were taken out of the assembly and told that they were going to be disciplined, which would, of course, been a blot on their academic records just when they were in the midst of college preparation. So they contacted us and said, "We think what we did was right." We said, "Absolutely." We fought with the school administration and eventually were able to win and say, "Listen, these students did not do anything wrong. As a matter of fact, you should be congratulating these students for engaging in the appropriate the use of their rights as citizens and modeling how we have an engaged electorate. So we're always incredibly proud when we meet students who really understand that the Constitution only stays alive when we as citizens choose to exercise the rights that we have under it.
Okay. As far as another aspect of the religion issue, as it relates to schools, the Supreme Court has said years ago that you can't be forced to, essentially got rid of prayer in school. And yet it's still done in some areas, and there's still states trying to pass legislation requiring them to say prayer in schools. What's being done on that front?
Yeah, it's a fascinating issue. So, one, I want to be really clear. There's discussions of prayer at the flagpole. So, for instance, before the school day starts, any student has the right to engage in prayer activities, to ask other students to join him or her in prayer activities. That's absolutely protected activity. ACLU actually once defended a young woman who, as her yearbook quote, wanted a quote from the New Testament. And the school told her, you can't do that. And she said, of course she can. That's an expression of her personal faith in a way that's showing what she believes. Now, conversely, can a teacher come and lead prayers, or can the principal come and ask everyone to join in prayers? Absolutely not. And why is that? Because that is those government employees making a statement of what prayer should be. Absolutely prohibited. Now, unfortunately, here in the state of Missouri, there was, in the Southern Rural County, a city that was beginning its council meetings with sectarian prayer, specifically in the name of Jesus Christ, which essentially says a message to those citizens who live there. If you are Christian, if you believe in Christ, then you are a favored part of this community. For others, you are disfavored. We represented a woman who had to proceed pseudonymously as a Jane Doe, but the court would not allow her to do so, and she was frightened because in a small community, you can be ostracized, you can be negatively impacted. So there are issues to deal with as we grow and become stronger throughout the state. We know we'll hear more and more about that, and certainly know that there are certain areas where there is an attempt to say the right religion. Our founding fathers knew that we need to protect the state from religion, and more importantly, we need to protect religion from the state.
Okay. And in terms of the voter rights, going back to that, is there current litigation pending in Missouri?
So, yeah, there's a few things going on. One, we finished our trial about 2-3 weeks ago. It was a 5-day bench trial in Federal District Court in St. Louis. The judge has asked for additional briefing. Very important litigation because it really points out the ways that people can game the system to exclude African Americans. We're doing a significant amount of work at the legislature, ensuring that we don't amend the Constitution, and we're looking at other places where litigation or education work might be necessary. As you know, voting is the most fundamental right. If you cannot vote, you cannot participate in the democratic process.
All right, and we're just about out of time, so I want to thank you for being here. For those of us who joined in the middle, we've been talking with Jeff Mittman. He's the executive director of the Missouri chapter of the ACLU, and we will have him back again on a future show. And join us next week when Brian Noland will be the host of